Please take your Bibles with me this morning and turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 2, second chapter of Ecclesiastes. As you're turning there, and before we get into our passage this morning, I want to mention that next week, Lord willing, Seth will be preaching the morning service, and then Greg Fletcher will be leading the evening study. I'll be away Thursday through Monday at a conference, and so we'll be down in D.C. area at a church conference down there. So I appreciate your prayers for the travel. Look forward to being back after this next weekend, but looking forward also to Seth's ministry. Appreciate him willing to do that and fill the pulpit here, and then for Greg leading in the evening. And so I appreciate their ministry in that way. Trust you'll look forward to that and pray for these men as well as they prepare this week. Ecclesiastes 2, our text today will be the first 11 verses of this chapter. And it's a lengthy portion. We're going to dive right in a moment. Before we explore this passage together this morning, I thought it good. We've been off a week, and so thought it good to just pull back into our minds what we've seen so far, what we looked at the last couple times in this book. And so let me just drop back to the chapter 1 in the beginning, Solomon's introduction, where he announces this stunning statement that the worst futility of life on this earth is that everything is futile. And that strikes us right in the face and really comes across to the point where we want to argue a little bit. And of course, Solomon takes that thesis and he develops that. And we said this, in a sense, what Solomon does is he gives us a two-legged stool. He gives us earthly and empty life. And we're left going, but there's got to be something that gives meaning and props that thing up. Because that's a really uncomfortable and unstable life to settle ourselves on. And so, what Solomon's begun to do in chapter 1 and then in chapter 2 is he's beginning to record his attempts at finding that third leg to prop up this earthly, empty life. And last time we were together in this book, we looked at chapter 1 and verses 12 through 18, and the first thing that Solomon records turning to is human wisdom. Maybe if I can figure things out and bring human wisdom to bear on the problems, the twists, the turns, the bends of life, I can figure this out. And ultimately we saw this, that if you lean your weight on human wisdom, you will ultimately fall. It's just not sufficient to be that third leg. And that brings us to the passage we're in this morning, chapter 2. Solomon brings us to his second attempt. Let's begin by just reading the first two verses of this chapter, and then we'll begin looking at this text together. Solomon writes, "I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it?" And if you keep reading, as we will look at more of this passage in a moment, it's pretty clear pretty quickly that what Solomon's turning himself to here is pleasure. He's giving himself over to a pursuit of pleasure. In addition to mentioning things like laughter, folly, and pleasure throughout these verses, we have that premise laid out very clearly in verse 1 where he counsels himself, commands himself, come now. That's a command. Come, let's go test pleasure. So very, very upfront, he lays it right out right away. But notice, this is a pleasure that we're going to add a description. It's a self-indulgent pleasure. Maybe that goes without saying, but it's important to note this. I'm just going to highlight a few things in the verses here. Solomon's seeking that which satiates self. Verse 3, I searched with my heart how to cheer my body. Verse 4, I built for myself. Verses 5 and 6, I made myself. And verse 7, I bought. I had great possessions. Verse 8, I gathered for myself. I got. I became great, surpassed all. Verses 10 and 11, my eyes, my heart, my reward, my hands. In other words, Solomon's pursuit of pleasure is aimed at his own self-indulgence. He's looking to pursue these pleasures for himself. And this week, as I was looking at this text, I thought, certainly it cannot be a coincidence that Solomon gives the most time in this two chapters of searching for this third leg. He gives the most time to the thing that I would argue is the thing that generation after generation after generation we tend to run after the most to find meaning in. You think of the other things, just compare the other things for a moment. Intellect, wisdom, you know, some of us have ability to maybe intellectually go far, think hard, go long, go deep, figure things out. But, you know, if I'm honest, I don't feel like I have that ability. I think I don't know that I can really figure a lot of deep things out, okay? And maybe you're there too, all right? Or think about even job, career, as he goes to later on in chapter 2. I'm going to give myself to my work. Maybe some of us go, well, I don't really have a job that I can look at and go, boy, I'm just going to throw myself into that and find meaning in life, right? But pleasure, we may not be able to pursue it on the scale that we're going to see Solomon pursue it, but we have ways and means of pursuing pleasure today in our world that is available to every single one of us. If nothing else, because we walk around with a little box in our hands that is a fountain of all these things, right? So pleasure is certainly one of those things, self-indulgent pleasure is certainly one of those things that most men and women searching for answers and meaning to life are going to pursue and at least test out. And Solomon actually gives us his conclusion right at the beginning. He's going to repeat it at the end, but look at verse 1 with me. He begins this, "But behold, this also was vanity." There's our Hebrew word again, hevel. This is vanity. Describing the pursuit of self-indulgent pleasure. It's futility. And verse 2 seems to highlight specifically the sense here of this word is a pointlessness. Look at verse 2. "I said of laughter, it's mad. And of pleasure, what use is it?" Now, it's not clear if the words laughter and pleasure in verse 2 are supposed to refer to different types of pleasure, enjoyment in life. Some have argued that, you know, laughter is this more surface pleasure, merriment kind of thing, and the other word is a little more deeper pleasure. I don't know, just kind of both ways. I would say this, what seems to be the case is Solomon's highlighting the extreme lack of satisfaction to be found in any kind of self-indulgent pleasure. And what he describes here as madness, when he uses that word madness, that's a word that's interesting if you look at it in our scriptures. It's very often translated praise. So if you think of the Psalms, and when they talk about praise God, that's the word used here translated mad in the ESV. It can be used in a positive way. It has the idea of boasting, but it also can be used in a negative sense. In the sense of boasting about self, arrogant boasting, or sometimes it's used this way, foolishness. You've heard someone spouting off about themselves, just running and running, and you go, that's foolishness. I don't have time for that. That's this word. And maybe the best sense that helps us go, okay, I see what's going on here, I think is for us in 1 Samuel chapter 21. This is the story of David fleeing King Saul, and he runs to his enemy, the Philistines, in the city of Gath. And he gets there, and the Philistines go, hey, we know this guy. Isn't he the one that all the Israelites sing, hey, you know, Saul's killed his thousands, but this guy's killed his 10,000s? And wait a minute, the 10,000s. Isn't that been a lot of us? And all of a sudden, David goes, uh-oh, I'm in trouble. Right, he fears. And so what he does is he begins to act like a crazy man. We're told this, that David, when he gets there, he pretended to be insane in their hands. That's our word. And so maybe this translation is spot on. Another translation says it this way, "I said to myself, have fun and enjoy yourself. But this didn't make sense. Laughing and having fun is crazy. What good does it do?" All of that to say this, where Solomon's, he's laying out, here's my premise, I'm going to check out pleasure, self-indulgent pleasure, just going to load it up. And here's my conclusion, I'll give it to you right at the start. It's pointless. Which brings us to the main point this morning, the proposition we're going to work with, and that is this, when self-indulgence becomes the end, there is no end to self-indulgence. And that has a couple meanings here. One, there's no end to self-indulgence in the sense you can never, we'll see this, you can never have enough to satisfy. See, that the catch with self-indulgent pleasure is that it gives you just enough to keep you coming back. And you never have just enough. But the other part of this is there's no ultimate end in the sense of Solomon's words, what's the point? What's the end of all this? So how does Solomon get to this conclusion? That's a pretty strong statement about a very large arena of life, like pleasure. Well, he does just what he commanded himself to do. He tests it out. And so verses 3 through 10 describe that test. We're going to look at that. And there's three things we're going to look at, ways that we're going to just take categorically here. I think this is going to help us also bring this to application as well. But three ways that he looks to pleasure to provide ultimate meaning, to prop up this thing, this empty earthly life. And the first thing is this. In verse 3, first, he tried consuming things that would bring pleasure. There's a consumption happening here in verse 3. If you look, Solomon turns to consuming wine to cheer his body, he says. If we just note a couple things about this consumption, first, it's from what's written here, this verse is a little hard to understand, language is a little difficult, but what seems to be happening here is this consumption is both an end, but also an aid to pleasure. In other words, what's happening here is Solomon acknowledges he consumed wine to cheer his body. I'm going to find pleasure in drinking this. But he also refers to it as being a means of learning how to lay hold on folly. So he's going to use this to somehow help him learn about pleasure, folly. All right? And I think there's something that we'll look at in a moment of how that works and how that would play out. Solomon takes what would have been a standard aspect of life, wine, and he uses it not merely to quench thirst or cure sickness, but as a source of pleasure itself. It becomes the end, as well as the aid. And the aid here, I would describe it this way. If you think about this man, as we're going to see, Solomon is king. He's king over a vast nation. And if you read his account in 1 Kings chapter 3 up through chapter 11, you follow the story of a man who should just grow in your mind as far as his oversight, his involvement, his leadership, his reign. You see a man, by the end of his story, you see a man who's really, in a lot of ways, got his fingers in everything. He's ruling over this vast nation. He's organized and coordinated. He's dealing with the pressures of that kind of a kingdom. A lot of stress, right? How do you just back off all of a sudden and go and pursue pleasure when you've got pressures like that? I think Solomon's giving us a hint. Look, I'm going to go ahead and drink wine, consume this for my own pleasure. I'm going to look for pleasure here, but I'm also going to drink this because I think it will relax me, help me kind of ease back off the stress a little bit, and now I can enjoy and kind of not be so worried about all those things going on. I'm not so uptight. Well, wine can do that. So first thing to note is this is both an end and an aid to pleasure. Second, notice his consumption is regulated pleasure. Solomon speaks of his mind still guiding him with wisdom. There's a little debate about what that exactly means. I land on the side. I believe what Solomon's getting at here is that even though he was using this means, this consumption of wine, he's still keeping his wits about him. And he's doing so because he's still trying to, as he's doing this, he's very cognizant, I want to be able to evaluate pleasure and evaluate these things rightly. So in other words, it seems like Solomon is saying, I'm not going overboard here and not getting just drunk and inebriated with no thought of what's going on. I'm entering into this and I'm keeping my wisdom about me to be able to evaluate this. It's a regulated consumption, a regulated pleasure. Maybe the words of King Lemuel's mother in Proverbs 31 were even around in Solomon's ears at this time. Those words say this, it's not for kings, O Lemuel, It's not for kings to drink wine or for rulers to take strong drink, lest they drink and forget what's been decreed and pervert the rights of all the afflicted. Maybe in Solomon's mind, he's very aware, look, if I go too far with this, everything's going to flip the other way. It's possible. Regardless, there seems to be some regulation here. In the midst of it all, Solomon sought to maintain a clear head so that he could see, as he says, what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their lives. It's interesting that what we see Solomon do here individually, we actually read of the whole nation doing corporately. 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 20, there's a brief mention of consumption that brought a certain level of happiness. We're told Judah and Israel were as many as the sand by the sea. They ate and drank and were happy. So even the nation itself has picked up on this. Let me just pause here for a second. And let's just think about this for a moment for our lives. What do we consume as an end or perhaps as an aid to self-indulgent pleasure? You know, the list is not limited to liquid we might swallow. It might be food that we ingest. Perhaps it's less physical intake and more visual or audible consumption, what we watch, what we listen to. I've chosen that word consuming specifically because it broadens this out for us. We're not just talking about one thing. We all go through life consuming things. And most of us go through life consuming certain things for pleasure. And there's a side of this we're going to see that isn't necessarily wrong. But where does that consumption bring us? We're people who consume, and we could say this, it's even commendable to consume with control, but remember our context, we're looking for that ultimate leg that props up this empty earthly life. And the warning here, the caution is, it's so easy for what we consume to begin consuming us. Be very careful. We so quickly, right? There's a line, and we so quickly step over it. We start enjoying something. Not bad, okay, enjoying this, consuming it. But there's a line, and we slip over it so fast, and we don't often recognize it. Proverbs 23 offers this warning about such a thing as wine. It says, who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has strife? Who has complaining? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes? Well, who has all these things? The passage answers, those who tarry long over wine, those who go to try mixed wine. You'll be like one who lies down in the midst of the sea, like one who lies on the top of a mast. They struck me, you will say, but I was not hurt. They beat me, but I did not feel it. When I awake, I must have another drink. It's the story of one whose the consumption has now consumed. And ironically, the very thing consumed for self-indulgent pleasure becomes the source of woe, sorrow, strife, complaint, and wounds, the very opposite of what one sets out to pursue and gain. It makes one dependent, to reuse the word addicted, moving the individual from sober consumer to the silly consumed one. And that warning applies in principle to everything we consume for such pleasure. Food, videos, games, books, blogs, news, art. You can broaden that out. You can go to a certain degree of your consumption that all of a sudden you find yourself controlled by the thing you're consuming. As good and enjoyable as some of these things may be, none of them provides ultimate support for this earthly empty life. Because ultimately, they will either end up not being enough, as we've said before, or it will end up being the thing that controls us. It's no longer the leg that I sit upon, it's now the leg that hands over me and beats me on the head. Interestingly, as I was looking this week, when Jesus was on earth, we look at his life, and he provided various things for people to consume, and frankly, many things people enjoyed. My mind went to a couple of things in the book of John. You have the story of him miraculously turning water into wine, and a whole party of wedding guests enjoys that. You have him feeding 5,000 people, over 5,000 people, with bread and fish, and thousands of people enjoy that. Their bellies are filled. I'm sure that was a pleasurable thing. Sitting all day in the sun, I'm hungry, and getting to finally eat some bread and some fish, I feel good, right? Interestingly, bottles empty and loaves disappear, and if you listen to Jesus, he says there's only one thing we can consume that will satisfy. And in John 6, he gets right to the point when a crowd comes following after him just after that whole feeding of the 5,000, and they go, "Where have you been?" And he goes, "You know, you're not looking for me because of what I offer you by teaching. You're looking for me because you want more bread. You're looking for the thing you can consume and get a little more pleasure out of." And Jesus says to them, "Look, I actually have bread that is going to satisfy forever." And they do what every thinking human being does. "Give us that bread." And Jesus says these words. He says, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger, and whoever believes in me shall never thirst." Folks, there is a consumption that will satisfy and support this earthly empty life. We're going to get more to this, but simply say it this way for right now. You must consume Christ. Consume Christ, because he's the only one who will turn around and consume you, and you'll be good consumed by him. So, Solomon gives himself to trying consuming things. Maybe that will bring pleasure. But secondly, Solomon tried accomplishing things. Maybe accomplishments will provide some pleasure. And accomplishments provide a certain amount of pleasure, don't they? Now, very often, the grander the accomplishment, the greater the pleasure. We celebrate accomplishments all the time. We do it with graduations. We do it with celebrations for degrees earned and medals won, for careers that have been promoted, for careers that have been successfully completed. We do it for all sorts of things in life. Perhaps accomplishment brings a pleasure that will satisfy. Even the simplest thing of accomplishing your to-do list for the day, right? That brings some pleasure. You finish the day and, aha, I got it all done. This is why you go back and you put things on your list and then cross it off just so you can say, "Look, I did a couple more things." Pleasure. Well, Solomon pursues this too. In verses 4 through 6, the persistent theme in these verses is the word made. Solomon makes things. Let's read these. "I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees." Now, it's likely, as we're going to see in a moment, Solomon's not the one doing all these things. All right? Maybe he did get himself a little bit dirty at times and go, "You know what, I'm going to try this out. Stonecutter, show me what you're doing here," right? He's talking broadly, but he's talking here about pursuing accomplishments in architecture and agriculture. He constructed buildings and curated beautiful gardens. And we have record of this, a lot of this, in 1 Kings and in 2 Chronicles. So what I want to do is I want to look at a few of these. We're going to look at the temple, the palace he builds. We're going to look at the cities that he builds. And then there's a quick reference to some terraces that he builds as well. So look at the temple, and as I do this, I'm going to put an illustration up on the screen and just take a look at this picture, this artist rendering of the temple. A little hard to see all the detail, but it gives a little bit of a picture as I read to you the description of this work. There's a lot in 1 Kings. I'm going to crunch it down and give you just kind of the Cliff's Notes version of it. So let me read this as you look at this picture. "Then King Solomon drafted forced laborers from all Israel. The labor force numbered 30,000 men. Solomon had 70,000 porters, 80,000 stonecutters in the mountains, not including his 3,300 deputies in charge of the work. They supervised the people doing the work. The king commanded them to quarry large, costly stones to lay the foundation of the temple with dressed stones. The temple that King Solomon built for the Lord was 90 feet long, 30 feet wide, and 45 feet high. The temple's construction used finished stones cut at the quarry, so that no hammer, chisel, or any iron tool was heard in the temple while it's being built. When he finished building the temple, he paneled it with boards and planks of cedar. Next, Solomon overlaid the interior of the temple with pure gold. He carved all the surrounding temple walls with carved engravings, cherubim, palm trees, flower blossoms, in the inner and outer sanctuaries. He overlaid the temple floor with gold in both the inner and the outer sanctuaries. In his 11th year, the temple was completed in every detail and according to every specification, so he built it in 7 years. How do you think Solomon felt after the 7 years were done? Do you think he had a little bit of pleasure as he walked out and sees this glistening building, gold, sitting in his city? And maybe even the thought, I did that. Or what about this? There's more. We're told about the palace. Solomon completed his entire palace complex after 13 years of construction. It took 7 years for the temple, 13 years, apparently, for his palace complex. He built the House of the Forest of Lebanon. It was 150 feet long, 75 feet wide, 45 feet high. He made the Hall of Pillars 75 feet long, 45 feet wide. He made the Hall of the Throne, where he would judge, the Hall of Judgment. It was paneled with cedar from the floor to the rafters. Solomon's own palace, where he would live, was of similar construction. And he made a house like this hall for Pharaoh's daughter, his wife. All of these buildings were of costly stones, cut to size, and sawed with saws on the inner and outer surfaces. From foundation to coping, and from the outside to the great courtyard, the foundation was made of large, costly stones, 12 and 15 feet long. Folks, I'm just 6 feet. Okay? Lay me on the floor, two of me, and there's the small stones that were used on the palace. Go 3 more feet, there's the big stones. Those are just the stones. He panels the whole thing with cedar. 13 years. And oh, while I'm at it, I'll build a separate home for my wife. You think when he finished this, he had a little bit of pleasure? What must move-in day have been like? Hey guys, come check this out. There's another one. Second Chronicles tells us of cities. At the end of 20 years during which Solomon had built the Lord's temple and his own palace, Solomon had rebuilt the cities Hiram gave him and settled Israelites there. Solomon went to Hamath-Zobah and seized it. He built Tadmor in the wilderness along with the storage cities that he built in Hamath. He built Upper Beth-horon and Lower Beth-horon, fortified cities with walls, gates, and bars. Baaleth, all the storage cities that belonged to Solomon, all the chariot cities, the cavalry cities, and everything Solomon desired to build in Jerusalem, Lebanon, or anywhere else in the land of his dominion. This man's going on a building spree. You know what? Jerusalem's not enough. Temple's not enough. Palace isn't enough. Let's go do some cities, guys. Do you think he had pleasure when he finished and stepped back and looked out and he could ride anywhere he wants and as he goes by, oh, I built that city. See that one? I built that. See that one? I built that and I populated it. I put all the people there. It's booming because of what I did. Do you think there was some pleasure in his heart at all the work done? And then there's this brief mention in 1 Kings 9 of what are called terraces. It talks about some supporting terraces built in the walls. And these terraces he built along with the house he built for his wife, the daughter of Pharaoh. Maybe these were something like the gardens that Babylon was known for. I don't know exactly what they looked like, but we know that Solomon also invested in agriculture, gardens, vineyards, and so as he rolls throughout the land in his chariot, he can look out and see, look at the things that have been built. Well, what's perhaps most interesting in these verses is that Solomon's language echoes the creative work of God back in Genesis 1 and 2. Let me give you some phrases from Genesis 1. We're told that God made the two great lights. God made the beasts. And even when he says in verse 27, let us make man in our image, that word make, that word is the word Solomon's using here. I made this, I made that, I made this, I made that. So maybe, possibly, Solomon's drawing on this to maybe emphasize this. I was pursuing paradise. And think of the pleasure. Think of the pleasure this man would get out of seeing the beauty, the grandeur, the scope, the scale of everything he's put his hand to. The coordination, the organization. It's not just one thing to go, wow, look at that building. It's also another thing to be able to go, boy, think of the hours that took. Think of the skill that was organized there. Think of the people brought in and all that was coordinated with that. Pleasure. Does it work? Does making self-indulgent pleasure through accomplishment, the grand goal, prop up this earthly, empty life? Well, to answer that, let me give you a quote from a 60 Minutes interview. It's more recent in history, but a 60 Minutes interview with a name that we know well, Tom Brady. He just won his third Super Bowl ring, and in this interview, he was asked something about if three was enough. And his response illustrates the elusiveness of self-indulgent pleasure through accomplishment. Here's what he replied. Why do I have three Super Bowl rings and still think there's something greater out there for me? A lot of people would say, I reached my goal, my dream, my life. Me? I think it's got to be more than this. I mean, this can't be what it's all cracked up to be. And the interviewer then asked Brady, what's the answer? And Brady responded this way, I wish I knew. I wish I knew. Certainly not the same wealth and status of Solomon, but here's another individual who's achieved great things, accomplishments, that most of the world would go, I would just love one of those. That'd be cool, right? I would love a little bit of that fame, a little bit of that momentary success. And he goes, just want more. I don't know. And I don't even know if that's enough. I wish I knew. The problem with accomplishments is that they fade. They fall apart. Records were made to be broken. And because we know they fade, accomplishments lure us into a pursuit of the next accomplishment and the one after that. We're back to our main emphasis. Again, accomplishment itself is not wrong. But remember the main point. When self-indulgence becomes the end, there's no end to self-indulgence. Well, there's a third thing. Solomon tried consuming, he tried accomplishing. Now, he's going to try owning things. I tried owning some things. Maybe that will bring pleasure. You've heard perhaps the lifestyle known as minimalism. It's kind of a fad these days. Minimalist lifestyle, get rid of as much as you can and live as simply as you can. Maybe a good idea. Not Solomon. Okay, he's going to do the maximized lifestyle. All right? So let's read. Verses 7 and 8, I bought male and female slaves, had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possession of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of man. Now we know from accounts in 1 Kings that Solomon had 40,000 stalls for horses and 12,000 horsemen. Just this morning in Sunday school, Greg was teaching us on the life of David, and we were looking at the life, that story about Nabal. And Nabal in Scripture is described as a very rich man. And I was noting what it went on to say. He's a very rich man. He has, I think it was 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. A very rich man. Well, get this. On the day the temple's dedicated, listen to the number of animals sacrificed by Solomon. Here we go. 22,000 cattle, 120,000 sheep and goats. If Nabal's a very rich man with 3,000, 2,000 sheep and 1,000 goats, what's Solomon when he has 22,000 cattle, he can go, here we go, one day, sacrifices, and then 120,000 sheep and goats. We get a little glimpse of the wealth this man has. He has slaves. He has servants, some born in his own house, which makes them his as well. You get this idea of just growing and growing and growing wealth. We have a glimpse of how much food it took to feed Solomon and his household just for one day. We add into this 1 Kings 4, Solomon's provision for one day, 180 bushels of fine flour, 360 bushels of meal, 10 fattened cattle, 20 range cattle, and 100 sheep and goats, besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and pen-fed poultry. Well, he had a big household, I'm sure, with all the servants and whatnot to feed and take care of, but that's still a lot of food. And that's daily. Solomon, in essence, we could say this, he owned all the grocery stores and was able to feed himself and his entire household daily and had plenty of extra to just go and give whatever he wanted, however he wanted, whenever he wanted. His wealth staggered calculation as well. If you ever had that nibbling thought, if I only had a few more dollars, I'd be happy. Or I think someone once made the comment that when they were asked, you know, how much is enough? Well, one more dollar. Right? The idea being just another dollar, just another dollar, just another dollar. There's never enough. Well, Solomon had incredible wealth. 1 Kings, again, records us some of this treasure. His fleet set sail, we're told, and he came back first trip with 16 tons of gold. The Queen of Sheba shows up, and as a little gift to this great king, she gives him 4.5 tons of gold. All right? And then, we're told this, the weight of gold that came to Solomon annually was 25 tons. Now, I did a little calculation this week, because 25 tons of gold doesn't really do a whole lot for me, so let me give you a little bit of calculation here. 25 tons of gold worth today, the price of an ounce of gold today is just over $2,100. So let's cut it at 2,000 even, just to kind of keep things clean numbers, okay? $2,000 an ounce. $2,000 an ounce, 25 tons of gold would be worth $1.6 billion. All right? Now, how many years did Solomon get this 25 tons of gold every year? I don't know. He reigned for 40 years. Let's go half. Let's go just 20 years of his reign. He got this every year, 25 tons, $1.6 billion coming in to his treasury. How much is that? Well, 20 years of 25 tons of gold coming in, $1.6 billion, that's $32 billion. So I still don't, okay. Well, let me go a step further. In today's current list of the world's billionaires, all right, $32 billion, the wealth, the valuation of just that gold coming into Solomon, none of the rest of his wealth, just the gold, puts him just about 40 people down from the top billionaire in the world. So add in everything else Solomon has, the spices, the precious stones, the silver, everything else in his wealth, Solomon's easily in the top 40 billionaires in the world today. Perhaps even the richest man. He has everything. Folks, even those numbers, I sit and I go, I have no idea how to even compute that. Except to go, that's insane. In other words, this man had all sorts of wealth that he owned. And we're told this in verse 8, he gathered to himself choirs and concubines. There's a little bit of a discrepancy or misunderstanding or interpretation issue in that verse. If you're looking at a King James, you might see just musical instruments. He gathered choirs, singers, and musical instruments. The word translated musical instruments there, though, seems to be better understood to be the word as in the ESV, concubines. There's a little bit of discrepancy, not sure, some lack of clarity there. I think in the context, it's probably best to go with that word concubines. We know this from 1 Corinthians 11, that Solomon amassed 700 wives, 300 concubines. In other words, this man is indulging himself in every possible pleasure. And everything is but ownership to him. The whole concept here is, what can I amass to own for myself and my own ends? And so he dives into the arts. He dives into intimacy. And he has given himself to every kind of sensual pleasure he could to see if it would prop up this earthly, empty life. And it's ironic, isn't it? If you look at 1 Kings 11 and verse 3, we're told that the very thing that Solomon gives himself to, these women, for pleasure, end up turning him and being his demise. Maybe that's what drives him later on to encourage his son in Proverbs 5, beware of the forbidden woman. Who is that? Well, Solomon, it was the 999 women you married after the first one. And he says, my son, if you go after this, You will give your years to merciless, and at the end of your life, you will groan. And I can't help but think Solomon's speaking there with a little autobiographical tone. I groan today. Self-indulgence. When self-indulgence becomes the end, there is no end to it. Jesus dealt with this tendency to pursue meaning and ownership. In that Sermon on the Mount, he says this, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth." Ownership. "Where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Jesus addresses the ownership, the things we possess in our lives. Is it wrong to have some of these things? No, certainly not. We're going to see Solomon come back to these things, many of these things, later on in the book and say, look, here it is, but it's this, it's a gift from God, so enjoy it as such. In closing, the summary of this section in verses 9 through 11, Solomon acknowledges, it's interesting, Solomon acknowledges he found what he's looking for. I found pleasure. That's in verses 9 through 11. He says this, "I became great, surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. I did it. I made it. Also, my wisdom remained with me. I did it. I made it. Keeping my wits about me, being able to evaluate things, all right? And whatever my desires, my eyes desired, I didn't keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this was my reward for all my toil." Here's the point. I found it. If you're wondering if I got it, yeah. But verse 11. "Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I'd expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun." The problem with pleasure is that pleasure itself is pointless. If we make it our ultimate end, if we make it our goal, we find it has no end. It keeps drawing us in, sucking the life out of us, a wicked slave master with but one goal, ultimately, to distract and drain our lives away from the one thing that truly matters and has meaning. What is that? Well, I want to finish this morning by pointing us in a direction. I already pointed us in this direction the last time, but I want to come back to it. Because in Genesis 3, I mentioned last time how Eve had looked at that tree, and when she chose to eat the fruit, she'd chosen something that would give her knowledge. She gave in. I'm going to take the knowledge. That's certainly going to be the prop for life. But it's interesting, in Genesis 3, we're also told this, that when she looked at that tree, she saw that it was something to be desired. It was something pleasurable. In other words, she's also looking at this tree and going, hey, that promises pleasure. And when Eve ate, when she took that fruit, she was giving in to a certain pleasure appeal. And the result, of course, was disastrous for her, Adam, and the rest of creation since. Let me wrap that up by bringing us to this thought. After that message last time, someone came to me and they gave a really helpful summary connecting some things that I don't think I made clear. They were kind of there in my mind, but when they said it, was like, yes, that's exactly right. So I'm going to kind of borrow that a little bit. What they said was this. They made the comment that Eve, in essence, swapped her relationship with God for wisdom and pleasure. Right? I have a relationship with God, and I'm standing at the tree, and boy, it looks really good, pleasurable. And hey, it would give me wisdom. Ooh, I'm going to take it and eat it. And what happened in that moment? There was an exchange that happened. I'm taking this, and I'll set that aside. Thank you very much. Exchanged a relationship. She left the one thing that gives meaning to this earthly and otherwise empty life, a relationship with God. The things we consume, accomplish, and own are not unimportant. Pleasure is not wrong, but they can sever and they can never replace the relationship with God we were made for. So let me ask you this morning, Do you have a relationship with God today, friend? Or have you been drowning yourself in all the pleasures of this world to somehow find some kind of meaning in life and some kind of purpose and some kind of fill the hole? Jesus Christ has made a relationship with God possible by paying for your sin by his death on the cross. Amen. And it's the only way to have a relationship with God. Do you want to go back and begin to get a little bit of what Eve exchanged there in the garden? It begins by coming to Christ for salvation. But then, Christian, let me address you for a moment. God is not anti-pleasure. This is a strict passage, and it's a stern caution and a really good and careful reminder. Be careful, Christian. God is opposed to anything that takes his place in our lives. You can enjoy this earthly empty life best when you enjoy it in the relationship with God you are made for. And here's the thing, a relationship with God will likely change what you consume. A relationship with God will likely shift you, it will shift you to labor for eternal accomplishments. A relationship with God will remind you, you own nothing in this world. You simply enjoy what God's put in your hand for this moment with the breath he's given you in this life. If we slip into this mentality, that's mine. And God wants to remind us, no, that's not. I gave it to you. It's yours to use for a time. But guess what? Someday, I will ask how you worked with it. You enjoy the good gifts from God's hand during a borrowed span of life provided by his breath in you. And the reality is this, you'll have to walk by faith that Psalm 16:11 is spot on when it tells us where true pleasure is to be found for all of eternity. It says this, "In your presence, Lord, is abundant joy. At your right hand are eternal pleasures." Right back to that relationship with God. One poor, unnamed Christian woman of the 18th century, I think, captured this reality best with these words. I'll close with this. She said, "I do not know when I have had happier times in my soul than when I've been sitting at work with nothing before me but a candle and a white cloth and hearing no sound but that of my own breath, with God in my soul and heaven in my eye. I rejoice in being exactly what I am, a creature capable of loving God, and a creature who, as long as God lives, must be happy." Amen. She hit it. As long as God lives. How long will God live?
Forever.
As long as he lives, here's her conclusion. I must be happy. I may not have any even close piece of what Solomon enjoyed in this life. And yet if I have God, if I have Christ, dear friend, you must be happy. At his right hand are pleasures forevermore. Let's pray.